This tape is entitled Who Shot JFK? Is given by Colonel Fletcher Prouty and recorded on Radio Liberty with Stanley Monteith.
Special privilege, we have a special guest this evening. His name is Colonel Fletcher, L. Fletcher Prouty, and he is the gentleman who was depicted in the film JFK as the mysterious colonel portrayed by Donald Sutherland, who sat on the bench with Jim Garrison and told Jim Garrison that he believed that there was a conspiracy at the highest echelons of our government to murder the President of the United States. Well, of course, Oliver Stone took a tremendous beating on that, and time and again, when he was interviewed on national television, he was always asked if the interview took place exactly as it was portrayed. And, of course, Oliver Stone would say, well, no, the interview didn't take place exactly that way, but, and then immediately he would be cut off. And I think one only has to see what happened to Oliver Stone, who dared to put out a movie challenging the preconceived notion, the establishment's explanation of the assassination, to see the tremendous power that is in the hands of those who have an intention and continue to intend to cover up the background behind the assassination of an American president. So, Colonel Prouty, are you there?
I certainly am. And I like your opening, Stanley.
Thank you so much, Colonel.
It's true to life.
Well, there's so much we have to talk about this evening, and let me give you our telephone numbers, but I'm going to ask you to hold your calls until later, until we've had a chance to explore some of the background behind the assassination and the events leading up to it, because it's vitally important that you have an opportunity to understand why it was important that JFK be assassinated. Now, Colonel Prouty's first book I read was The Secret Team, and I guess that was published, what, 20 years ago?
Yes.
And then the latest book, The CIA, Vietnam, and the Plot to Assassinate John Fitzgerald, or John F. Kennedy. And this is available. I got my copy down at Neil Coonerty's bookstore. It's an excellent book, and I would recommend it highly to anybody who wants to get into the background of what we're going to be talking about tonight. And I suppose we really ought to start out with a little bit about you. Could you tell us what you were doing back in November of 1963 at the date when President Kennedy was assassinated? What was your position in the government at that time?
On that date, I was the Chief of Special Operations within the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, that title is a military euphemism for what the National Security Council directed us to do, called supply the military support for the clandestine operations of CIA.
And
now, I had been doing that in various capacities at the Air Force, the Office of Secretary of Defense, and in the Joint Chiefs of Staff area for 9 consecutive years, 1955 to 1964. So my assignment in November 1963 was the support of the clandestine activities of CIA. And by having it at the JCS level, that meant that we controlled and guided all services in their support. And most people would be very much surprised to find the magnitude of that job. It ran into thousands of people all the time.
Now, did you have any responsibility as far as guarding the president, when he was touring around the country?
Well, that varied depending upon requests that came to us from the people who are required to do that work, the Secret Service. But just in anticipation of your question, I looked in the Washington Post this morning and saw that from the time Bill Clinton arrives in Charlottesville today through the time he leaves for the ball Thursday, more than 6,000 law enforcement officers will have helped protect him. Now, of course, the Secret Service doesn't have that strength, so they call upon military forces. And at times, in fact, I myself traveled for such activities. At times, we would deploy specially trained units to provide the help and the manpower for the protection of the president.
Now, there was something about Dallas. Had there been another attempted assassination in Dallas on De Gaulle? What was the background behind that story?
Well, there were two things in Dallas. One was that a General Walker, who had come home from his NATO command, actually had been released from service for various things he had done and things he had said, allegedly was fired at from outside his house. A shot went through the window and so on. So that was one event. But another one that was more nationally prominent was that Adlai Stevenson, the man who ran against Eisenhower for president, and who was, I believe, at the time of Kennedy's period of time, was the UN ambassador to New York for the government, had a terrible time in Dallas. In fact, things were thrown at him. He was spit upon, and really a very inhospitable visit to Dallas not long before Kennedy's trip. In fact, people wanted to suggest that Kennedy should not go to Dallas because of those problems.
I see. And but you weren't allowed to do anything to be concerned about this. You were sent out of the country specifically on some sort of a nonsensical assignment?
Yes. You know, this was rather interesting. Of course, in my work, I traveled an awful lot. During my tour, I traveled to more than 80 countries. So I wasn't unfamiliar with being asked to go on rather strange trips. But sometime in October, I was told by a general to go over to the White House annex to get orders for a trip to the South Pole. A group of people were going to install a nuclear plant at the South Pole, and they needed a military escort officer. And I was astounded to find out that from my work and from the things I was generally responsible for, that I was going to be sent to the South Pole. And actually, I was in Christchurch, New Zealand, on the day that President Kennedy was killed.
And didn't you comment that many of the members of the cabinet, of the president's cabinet, were sent out of the country or were out of the country at the time of the assassination?
Yes, I've tried very carefully in my book to present this in detail, and I commend really to any student of this period one of the most unusual events that I can recall in my long service. The entire Kennedy cabinet, give or take one or two people, I mean the Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary of Interior, and so on, so were in Honolulu on their way to Tokyo, and they were in an airplane between Hawaii and Tokyo when they learned that the president had been shot. Now, why were they sent out of the country at that time? You see, those important people, and the newspapers lead up to that rather well, and then rather abruptly excuse the trip and all, but strangely enough, on newspapers of about the 24th and 25th of November 1963, you can find that they print, supposedly, speeches that were delivered in Japan by these cabinet members. In other words, their public relations people had sent the speeches ahead, and the newspapers, without thinking, published that. It's a very strange period in our history.
Well, there are lots of strange things about the assassination, the magic bullet that went through both JFK and then Conley, and then appeared in pristine condition, just laying on a stretcher there at the Parkland Hospital. But we can go into a lot of those challenging things. Before we actually get into the assassination itself, maybe we can spend a few minutes talking about what led up to Vietnam. And the rather shocking statement that you made, and of course I was aware of this, but I don't think most people were, and that is that America originally backed Ho Chi Minh at the Second World War with the fall of the Japanese, the defeat of the Japanese. The Ho Chi Minh, who was certainly known as at least as a Marxist, as a socialist, had the full backing of the OSS.
Well, you see, again, it is very difficult to look back from this point in history at 1944 and 45, the war ended in 45, September 2nd, and place the people in power and the people in different positions the way they really were. But believe it or not, Ho Chi Minh, the man that we fought that war against in Indochina for more than 20 years, Ho Chi Minh came down to Hanoi with an American Army general named Gallagher and a man from the OSS named Lew Konin. And because we did not have to invade Japan as a result of the use of the atomic weapons, we had planned to invade Japan with 500,000 troops. The equipment, the guns, the artillery, the ambulances, the jeeps, the radios, everything for 500,000 men were piled up on Okinawa, just piled up like apartment buildings, the crates and boxes and pallets. And they were all of a sudden moved and put on transport vessels, this equipment for 500,000 men, and half of it was sent, and this is September 45, half of it was sent to Syngman Rhee in Korea, where we had a war in 1950, and the other half was delivered to Ho Chi Minh in Hanoi in September 45. We backed Ho Chi Minh. We created the force of his army by giving him all these modern weapons, and then eventually turned around and became his enemy when we supported the French in their drive to regain their colonial power in Vietnam until they were defeated in 1954 at Dien Bien Phu, defeated by the weapons that we had provided to Ho Chi Minh ourselves. It's quite a story.
Well, you know, some people say that we sometimes have the best enemies money can buy, and certainly you commented in your book that most of the weapons, literally all of the weapons, that Ho Chi Minh and his forces were using against the French were American weapons that we had sent there in 1945, and then those were the same weapons that were used against our forces and against the Vietnamese forces during the Vietnamese War.
You know, you can add to that, when Ho Chi Minh defeated the French at Dien Bien Phu, by that time we had provided the French over $3 billion worth of arms, everything from aircraft to rifles, mortars, grenades, the works. And of course, he fell heir to all of that as a result of his victory in 1954.
And then you begin to develop the idea that we brought Mr. Diem, President Diem, knew his brother into power, and they set out to destabilize South Vietnam. At that point, Ho Chi Minh controlled the north part of Vietnam, and Diem and his brother controlled the south part of Vietnam. And you mentioned a number of things that they'd done, actually, to destabilize this society. Would we go a little bit into the background? Because I think it's fascinating for the listeners to understand that this was a traditional, very conservative society, was a stable society, and suddenly, with CIA and American interference, we literally destroyed the whole fabric of that society.
One of the most unnoticed events of the Vietnam warfare period was the movement of 1,100,000 North Vietnamese to the south. Now, just imagine if 1,100,000 people from, we'll say, Seattle, were suddenly moved to Santa Cruz and just left there. You know, no homes, no money, no food. You'd have counterinsurgency just so they could eat. I mean, they'd be stealing food. What else could they do? But that was done in Vietnam under the guise of being a humanitarian effort, because the Geneva Accord when the French finally were defeated had a little paragraph that said that anyone in the north who chooses to live in the south will be permitted to do so, and anyone in the south who chooses to live in the north can do so. And they thought, you know, several hundred people might move, or various people for financial interests or whatever might move. But the CIA had created an organization called the Saigon Military Mission. It was infrequently in Saigon. It was not a military mission, and most of its activity were what you and I would call today terrorism in North Vietnam. And as a result, over 1,100,000 people were moved south. 660,000 were moved by U.S. Navy vessels, and the other 300 or so thousand were flown in airplanes, transport aircraft, that were under the control of the Central Intelligence Agency. And interestingly, there's only one major port in South Vietnam, and it's at Saigon. It's up a river. So they brought these people up the river, dumped them out of the ships, ostensibly said they would take care of them in little towns and so on, but they scattered all through the most luxurious part of Vietnam, the southern part, the rice fields, the paddies, the wealthy villages there. And of course, being homeless and penniless, they demanded food, they demanded help, and they became an enemy that very soon we called Viet Cong. We called their activity insurgency, and we began to fight insurgency. But the strange thing was, it's as though Canada wanted to attack the United States, but started fighting in Florida. How could that be done? Well, the main part, the most agitation in the war, at least in the time that Kennedy was president, was in the very southern part of Vietnam, the furthest away from North Vietnam. And that was due to this forced movement of that enormous number of people. And you know, Vietnamese don't travel. They live in villages, and they have what they call ancestor worship. They don't drive around in their cars. They stay there for centuries in the same village, and then you uproot a million of them, and you think you're going to create a stable. It was really one of the most make-war efforts ever done in any country by anyone.
And then, of course, there were a number of sects there. There was the Cao Dai, and there was the Buddhists, and there were a number of people who had... They were stabilizing forces to the community. They'd been there for, I suppose, hundreds of years. And they were, one after another, undermined. There was a man named Lee Van Vien or something. He was sort of a pirate south of Vietnam, south of Saigon, and he was gotten rid of, and the emperor was gotten rid of, and the Cao Dai was gotten rid of. And what were all those various organizations? Why did we undermine the fabric of this society, this peaceful society?
I think the big word, give or take, that by giving them all those arms, we intended to have a war there. I think that we would admit, if we looked at all the facts, that our activities were to create a war for reasons that are still not entirely clear. I think we could clarify them if we thought about them very long. But that's the first thing. And to make a war, there's nothing better than to transplant stable people, take them away from their homes, their villages, their farms, their activities, whatever they're doing. A lot of people in Vietnam were in the lumber business. Many of them worked for the enormous French Michelin tire company and were very well employed. Vietnam was, according to the National Geographic, was the nearest thing the National Geographic could say with the Garden of Eden on Earth. It was a beautiful place. In fact, I was a transport squadron commander over there in the latter part of 1953 and 54. Now, in 54, remember, that was when the Battle of Dien Bien Phu took place. There's plenty of fighting going on in Vietnam. But from Tokyo, I was ordered by the generals who were fighting our Korean War, or winding it up at that time, to fly wounded and hospitalized men to Vietnam for rest and rehabilitation on those wonderful beaches in the southern part of Vietnam. In other words, the men winding up the Korean War thought Vietnam was a resort, was a Waikiki or a beach country, Monterey and Carmel, let's say. And so I had about 12 aircraft in my squadron. I would get orders to fly hundreds of men to Vietnam, not for warfare, but to go to the beaches and recover from injuries and so on. That's the way we were split. The military thought Vietnam was a Garden of Eden. The CIA was producing a war ground.
And, of course, one of the things you brought out I thought was so interesting was that the CIA convinced President Diem to force all of the Chinese out of the country. And, of course, they were the merchants. They were the people who made the society work economically.
Yes, you know, if you live in that kind of an economy, and actually Vietnam was quite wealthy as things go, they exported 600,000 tons of rice a year just before the war began to peak. In other words, their balance of trade was plus for them. And obviously, if you're a rice farmer, fixed to your land, no trucks, no highways, you depend upon some sort of a brokerage system to bring your rice to market. Now, the old system was that you would go down the canal in your own boats delivering your rice to the village, mark your rice, and then the Chinese would come at every harvest time, and the Chinese would barter, trade for textiles, for silver, for salt, and other necessities, and would buy the rice and put the rice on the world market. And for hundreds and hundreds of years, that system of the Chinese entrepreneur and the Vietnamese farmer had made all of those people in the southern part of Vietnam relatively prosperous farmers. And it was a peaceful deal if we hadn't come along and ruined it, it would still be that way.
And this was, of course, the CIA in those years between 54 and 63 when the president was assassinated. From what you said, we forced the French out, and they were a stabilizing influence. We forced out the Chinese. We destroyed the sects. We brought in the
1,100,000 people into South Vietnam, and all of this was being engineered by the CIA?
Well, you see, this is another thing that people don't seem to recall or put in context. As I said, when we first went down there with Ho Chi Minh, one of the principal leaders there was from the OSS, the forerunner of CIA. The CIA stayed in Vietnam all through that period. By about 1959, 1960, the CIA felt that they needed helicopters. So they called upon the military, in fact, they called upon my office, to provide the first squadron of helicopters. Now, they are military helicopters flown by military pilots and with military maintenance people. The Department of Defense did not approve that request for the CIA because we felt that it went against the agreements of the Geneva Accord in 1954. But through measures that Alan Dulles was able to use, especially with his brother being the Secretary of State, we were called by the White House, National Security Council, and ordered to provide the helicopters. Now, in order to do that, we had to bring in military people who were competent to fly them and maintain them and supply them and all that. So that introduced military people into Vietnam, but not for combat purposes, and most importantly, not under their military officers. It was 1965, 20 years after we had made our first moves into Vietnam, that military troops, U.S. Marines, landed on the beach at Da Nang, and served under their own military officers. That's the first time the military was involved. Now, you see, that's after Kennedy's time by 2 years. And yet people think that Kennedy is, caused the escalation in Vietnam. It's absolutely wrong.
In fact, actually, Kennedy, shortly before he was murdered, had actually written a directive that we were going to start pulling out of Vietnam, hadn't he?
This is the most contentious point of Oliver Stone's movie and our attempt to tell history as it is. Because on October 11th, 1963, after months of careful study and the management of his top leaders, Secretary Rusk of the State Department, Secretary McNamara of the Defense Department, and his National Security Council, and many, many assistants from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, among them my own boss, General Krulak, they were planning a policy that Kennedy was dictating to them, that we were going to bring all U.S. personnel out of Vietnam by the end of 1965. Now, those words that I've just said are quoted from a document that was issued by the White House, the highest level document the White House could issue at that time, called a National Security Action Memorandum. It's number 263. And despite the fact that the document can be obtained in any library, it's in many books, but poorly quoted, and in the Pentagon Papers, the so-called history of the war, it's terribly presented. They fractured it. They put half one place and half another place. But never mind those problems. The document exists. It was Kennedy policy. My boss worked on it. I worked on it myself. I know about it. And furthermore, there is now a marvelous government printing office book called The Foreign Relations of the United States for the period August to December 1963, Vietnam, Volume 4, and that book relates a whole series of meetings leading up to that document, what it meant, and what Kennedy's intentions were. There can be no doubt, despite the fact that every newspaper and magazine says that Stone and I were wrong on this, there can be no doubt that that's the history of the event, the way it really happened.
Now, for a guess, anybody who may have just tuned in, let me remind you that you're listening to Radio Liberty here on KFER 89.9 FM on your radio dial. Our guest this evening is Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, who actually served as the consultant to Oliver Stone for the movie JFK, and was depicted in the part played by Donald Sutherland. Well, we're going to get to the assassination itself here in just a few minutes, but there were a number of other items that you felt were important. In other words, Kennedy wanted to pull out of Vietnam, and there were people who wanted a war there. In fact, they'd been working at that point almost 10 years to destabilize Vietnam. They had financed very well the enemy. Ho Chi Minh, having gotten half of the equipment we'd sent from Okinawa, and then all the American military equipment left over that we had given to the French after Dien Bien Phu. So there was a situation. This was an ideal situation for a war, if you wanted one. And here's this upstart young president coming along and saying he wants to pull all of our troops out, get everybody out by 65. What other things did our president do to irritate or antagonize the establishment?
You know, in the context of that question, I just can't help but think of the immediate situation, because our new president is inheriting one or two real major trouble spots on an ongoing arrangement that has not been really solidified as far as policy goes. When Kennedy became president, the Bay of Pigs program was in motion already. The men had been trained. They were in foreign countries being trained. They had an air force. The Bay of Pigs Cuban exiles had an air force larger than any air force in Latin America. They were equipped with enough weaponry so that had they established their foothold on the beach, they could equip 25,000 people to help them in their goal to overthrow Castro. It was no casual event. Historians have not done well by the facts of this case. But Kennedy inherited that. The decision to train the Cuban exiles had been made originally in the Eisenhower administration time in March of 1960. The invasion of the brigade in Cuba, as you will recall, came in April of 1961, or in other words, a year later. So Kennedy inherited the program in motion. In fact, when Alan Dulles briefed him about this program, Alan Dulles said something to the effect, and this is in print and can be looked up by anyone who's interested, that, "Mr. President, it would not be wise now to change the policy that we already have begun, because all these Cubans are in training and all these Cubans expect to go back and defeat Castro, et cetera, et cetera." In other words, gave him no alternative. And then finally, when Kennedy approved the movement of the brigade for the invasion on a Sunday, April 16th, before the day they were to land on the beaches, there was one more step. We had had a bombing run over Cuba on Saturday, on April 15th, because Castro had 10 combat-capable aircraft. He had no big air force. He had 10. In that Saturday morning raid, our B-26s, the Cuban exile B-26s, destroyed 7 of his aircraft. Unexpectedly, 3 of his aircraft, and they were jets called T-33s built by the Lockheed Company and well-armed, had flown to another city, Santiago, and they were not touched by that raid. So when the military chiefs and the CIA people briefed Kennedy on Sunday, and oddly enough, Alan Dulles, the director of Central Intelligence, was out of the United States on that crucial date. This is something that few people have ever been able to explain, why the man in charge wasn't there. So Eisenhower went off to play golf instead of being leader of the invasion of Normandy.
Unless maybe it was intended to lose.
Well, see, A lot of those questions come up when people begin to know the facts of the case. Obviously, that kind of a question rises. What was his intention? Why did he do that sort of a thing? But anyway, on Sunday afternoon, when the military briefed the president and told him such things, and I'll read this. This is factual. "The Cuban Air Force and naval vessels capable of opposing our landing must be knocked out or neutralized before our amphibious shipping makes its final run on the beach. The realization that the main reliance for the destruction of Castro Air Force must be placed on the D-Day strike," that's the strike the morning of the landing, "Kennedy approved," he ordered the D-Day strikes. And yet, in this report that I have, we find that in paragraph 43, under the highlights of the operation, a committee study put together by at direction of Kennedy, they write this. At about 9:30 p.m. on 16 April, Mr. McGeorge Bundy, Special Assistant to the President, telephoned General C.P. Cabell of CIA to inform him that the Dawn airstrike the following morning should not be launched until they could be conducted from a strip within the beachhead. Mr. Bundy indicated that any further consultation with regard to this matter should be with Secretary of State. Now, General Cabell was the deputy to Dulles. He was a good intelligence officer, but he was not a combat commander. From the time he got the call and he ordered the cancellation of the strike that Kennedy had, because of this call, he ordered the cancellation of the strike, even though he knew the president had directed it. And then, as the story goes, he went around Washington trying to locate Secretary Rusk. Well, in the meantime, as the clock ran, the time for them to take off in these B-24s that were going to bomb the jets, do that, and when the brigade landed on the beach, two of their ships were immediately sunk by these three jets. They were strafed and beat up by the jets. We lost 16 planes to the jets, and the brigade did not succeed, as the report, again, that was written by Maxwell Taylor in the attendance with Alan Dulles and with Admiral Burke and Bobby Kennedy, the committee that had been assigned, they summed it up by saying the cancellation of the strikes planned for dawn at D-Day, they say the last mention was probably the most serious cause of failure, as it eliminated the last favorable opportunity to destroy the Castro Air Force on the ground.
Well, you know, the way they've rewritten history, they always tell us that we were supposed to send in an American Air Force cover, you know, and Kennedy wouldn't send in the American Air Force. And the fact that it wouldn't involve our Air Force at all, it would involve the CIA covert Air Force, which had all the cover on it, but that isn't brought out at all. It's the idea that Kennedy wouldn't ask the Air Force or the Navy to come in to protect them, and yet this thing was all planned out in one man, McGeorge Bundy. And our listeners, later on, we're going to give you a lot more information on George Bundy, because I think that he is one of the most sinister individuals in contemporary history, and we'll tell you a little bit more at another date about the part he played in bringing us into Vietnam. And I think he's a very unreliable individual, and I think he misused his power tremendously. So the Bay of Pigs then failed, and Kennedy was furious. And what was his reaction to the CIA at that time? He felt that they'd really betrayed him, didn't he?
Again, we get one of these major turning points in our government. Because this study group that Kennedy had established, all experts, very different personalities, just imagine a room where these different people had to meet every day. General Maxwell Taylor had been chief of staff of the Army. Admiral Arleigh Burke was the chief of naval operations and the most knowledgeable man of the military support of the Bay of Pigs operation. Alan Dulles himself, the longtime director of Central Intelligence, and the man who sat in the corner quietly in a chair and listening to every word, Bobby Kennedy, the president's brother. Those four men were asked to make this study of what happened and why the operation didn't succeed. Well, when they finished, they not only wrote these paragraphs, one or two of which I just read, but they wrote the proposal for future operations so that the Bay of Pigs and things like that would not be repeated. And what they did was write another National Security Action Memorandum, this time number 55, a very important paper that historians have just completely scrubbed out of the books, that says that the president considers the Joint Chiefs of Staff to be his advisors in peacetime as they would be in wartime for what were called peacetime operations, or another euphemism for clandestine operations. This policy definitely, had Kennedy lived, would have removed the CIA from any participation in major clandestine operations.
And
that
then
was a very powerful statement. but Kennedy was killed and he didn't have the chance to carry that out.
And actually Kennedy fired Allen Dulles, didn't he, and was moving to try to strip the CIA of its power?
Well, he did. He fired Allen Dulles and he fired General Cabell and Mr. Bissell, the three men who were most responsible for the Bay of Pigs program and really the three senior people of the CIA. Nothing like that has happened since the CIA was established in 1947.
And so Kennedy really went on record, and at one point in your book said, you made the comment that he said he was going to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces.
It's reported that he was talking with his good friend, Chief Justice Douglas, and told him that he said, I'm going to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces, and that's been quoted by many writers and has appeared in many newspapers.
And so we approach then November of 1963. Kennedy has put out a directive that we're going to get our troops out of Vietnam. What was it? 1,000 out by the end of that year, and all of our troops out by 65.
Yes, and you know, it's hard to express what that did as it went around through the higher levels of official Washington. Power centers within the city and within the government had been leaning toward a major war. I mean, just think, 550,000 men fought in Vietnam at one time. I don't know if you've ever heard this figure. 10 million men were flown to Vietnam during the Vietnam War, that means after 1965.
Back and forth.
By commercial contract airlift. 10 million men were, at one time or another, involved in Vietnam, a major war. But Kennedy was not going to do, he was not going to put Americans there. And this developed pressures within the city, within the military, within what we call, or what Eisenhower called, the military-industry complex, within other power groups who look forward to the windfall of some $200 to $550 billion that we eventually spent in Vietnam that would not have been spent, and the 10 million men would not have been involved. It's a major thing when Kennedy said, I'm going to take all U.S. personnel out of Vietnam by the end of 55. And the way that was worded also tells us a story. He didn't write all U.S. military personnel. He said all U.S. personnel, because in 63, the predominant number of people in the operating and command positions in Vietnam were CIA people. They were coming out. Well, when he did that, you could go into a meeting somewhere, and anybody that mentioned the name Kennedy would start an uproar. They hated him.
And you were in the military, you were going to those meetings, and everybody hated Kennedy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Bad to say.
And one of the things that we talked about earlier when I called you today, and I just want to mention this for the listening audience, and I don't know how you feel about it, but there was, and I remember this very well, because I had a very good friend who was involved with the gold mining and with money and studying the monetary system, and that is that President Kennedy had also talked about doing away with the debt currency that we have. In other words, all the money that we have in circulation, interest is paid to the Federal Reserve System. It's not simply a dollar in circulation, it's a debt currency unit. And he was talking about having the government issue money that didn't pay money to the Federal Reserve. He was concerned about that. That happened perhaps a few weeks before he took his trip to Dallas.
Well, you know, it's good to have you broaden it this way, because it wasn't just Vietnam, and it wasn't just the Bay of Pigs. The Kennedy administration came into power at a very important time in our history, following World War II and the changes that came after that, following the recognition of the fact that the hydrogen bomb had become so powerful that there was no way you could use it for victory in a major war. And this was causing all kinds of concern within the government and within industry as to which way we're going to go. If you've read the introduction to my book that was written by Oliver Stone, you'll notice how people, as he dwells on the subject and broadens it very much, how people were deeply concerned about the future of our government faced with those problems. And it wasn't just Vietnam, but the money problem, you are right. The banking problem is another thing. And I'm a graduate of the Graduate School of Banking at Madison, Wisconsin, and I know quite a bit about banking. One of my instructors was Arthur Burns, the head of the Federal Reserve System, and I could talk about that all day with pleasure, because when you start fooling with the Federal Reserve System, you get a lot of people up in arms. And it was all of that. You know, Kennedy had revised the TFX procurement program. Probably most people have forgotten that the airplane is called the F-111 now. But that program in 1960 was worth about $6.5 billion, the biggest procurement program ever to be led by the Air Force and the Navy. And when Kennedy came in and McNamara, they changed that from a program that was presumed to go to the Boeing Company and allocated it to a combination of the General Dynamics Company and Grumman for reasons that would have really changed the procurement system of the Pentagon. Now, you don't do that lightly. So all of these things were adding up against Kennedy. There was no one thing that caused his death, and certainly not one man with an old beat-up rifle. There were many, many power centers that coalesced until there was a consensus that led to a decision that had him killed professionally by experts.
And there, of course, there are many, many stories. There are some 600 books or something like that written about the assassination, each one challenging the other and creating sort of a state of confusion on the part of people who read them. And you just you don't know whether it was the Cubans or the Mafia or the lone assassin theory. There's so many books out there that people really can't look at what happened clearly and realize that the story of the lone assassin just is totally preposterous.
You know, this is a human trait, human nature. Stanley, if you decided you wanted to rob the bank down the street, it'd be very convenient for you to have dinner tonight with a couple old friends and tell them you were going to Las Vegas for a week. See, you were going. So these old friends and others you told could swear in court it couldn't have been you robbing the bank. You were in Las Vegas. And furthermore, you probably had a couple of friends in Las Vegas tipped. In other words, the creation of a cover story is more important than the crime, because that's how you make a successful crime. If you don't have a good cover story, your crime's not a success. Well, now, the proof of the massive nature of the crime that led to the conspiracy, I'll call it conspiracy, there's no other word for it, that led to the death of Kennedy, was the fact of this cover story that has existed now for more than 29 years. You cannot get a single president of the United States to say that, oh, I don't believe Oswald did it, I don't believe anybody else did. Oswald did it. I don't believe there was a conspiracy. Each president, one after the other, says Oswald did it the way the Warren. And you know, if you study the Warren Commission report for 15 minutes, you know it is false. It's mythology. But as you say, about 600 books have been written. Any newspaper in this country will print tomorrow that Oswald killed Kennedy. We have senators in Congress who will stand up and say Oswald killed Kennedy. In fact, one of the senators in Congress is this fabulous magician who created the magic bullet. And he's a senator in Congress, and he tells us that bullet fired by Oswald from the sixth floor up went into Kennedy's back, out of his throat, into Connolly's back, through his ribs on the right side, broke his ribs, hit his wrist and broke the wrist bones, kept going and went down into his thigh, and to this day, Connolly has parts of that bullet in his thigh that they have not extracted. And this fine gentleman in our Senate invented that story because they had to keep the number of bullets down to three, so he had one bullet do the job of about five.
Is that our Senator Specter?
Yes,
all right. Well, in one place in the book, and I think that everybody really would want to get a hold of this book, Vietnam, the CIA, and the plot to kill Kennedy. I hope I have that in the right sequence. Where they quote Lyndon Johnson shortly before his death as saying that he believed the assassination in Dulles had been part of a conspiracy, and he said, "I never believed that Oswald acted alone, although I can accept that he pulled the trigger. We've been operating a damn murder incorporated in the Caribbean." That quote comes from the Atlantic Monthly, July of 1973. I wonder why most of our public never heard that quotation.
Well, you know, that's a very important item, because let's step back just a little bit. On the 29th of November in 1963, Lyndon Johnson had a list of names in his hand that he was going to appoint the Warren Commission, and he wanted to check that list, as they're doing with lists today for President Clinton, with the director of the FBI. So he called Hoover over. Most people may not remember that Hoover and Johnson were neighbors for 19 years in Washington, knew each other very well. So after they talked about the Warren Commission nominees, and Hoover approved all of them except one, Johnson leaned over to Hoover, and I have a copy of this written memorandum signed by Hoover, by the way. I mean, it's current history. You can read this. He turned to Hoover and he said, "How many bullets were fired?" Hoover said, "Three. We have them. We have the cases. We know the rifle. We have three of them." And then Johnson said, "Were any fired at me?" Imagine, Lyndon Johnson was two cars back. Theoretically, this gunman was way up on a sixth floor, and somehow Johnson felt that a bullet or more might have been fired at him, and he asked Hoover, of all people, "Were any fired at me?" See? So you know very well that Johnson was educated by those bullets. And later, in 1973, after he had had very serious heart trouble and knew that he was not going to live much longer, he called an old reliable friend and writer, Leo Janus, and they had a long discussion down at his ranch at Peter Nowlis. And Janus wrote a beautiful article in the 1973 July issue of the Atlantic Monthly Magazine, which any of you can get on microfilm in your library. And he said these three things, and these are very important. He said, "I always knew it was a conspiracy, the murder of Kennedy. I knew that Oswald did not do it, at least not alone. And third, and this is the most important statement of all," he said, "we maintain a murder incorporated." Now, most people have no awareness of what is called a murder incorporated within a government. But now think back. You know what a firing squad is. A government has firing squads. You know what an electric chair is. You know what the guillotine is. Governments have the power, the authority, and the system to kill people. And in Lyndon Johnson's times, he said, "We maintain a murder incorporated." What he meant by that was that Kennedy had been killed by professionals who work on contract, and I can affirm that they're not in the United States. They live in a place outside, and I know about them. And they are on call if the right source makes the call through certain codes, and a man like Kennedy can be killed. Now, it's that simple. It's that terrible, and it's that true. And Johnson said it all.
And you worked in the higher echelons of government, and this sort of thing is actually done as part of covert operations?
Regrettably, I'll have to say yes, because we know that there are assassinations. I worked for a general during my term that we've described who came back from a meeting at the White House, burst into the office, and said, "Prouty, go down to personnel and get my retirement papers." My God, he was a general with a big job. I went down and got them and came back. "So what's the matter, General?" He said, "They've decided that so-and-so," and he named the man, head of a country, "has to be killed." He says, "I don't want any part of that." So he retired. The next week, the man he was talking about was killed. Now, I can't say that I was there. I can't say that I knew exactly how he was killed. But that general had been at the White House. That general told me he got his retirement papers, and he left on account of that. And then I also know how the business operates, wrote about it in my book.
Yes, you
said. I don't think that Johnson was fabricating anything. He knew that we operated a murder incorporated.
I think one of the most interesting things you had suggested before we have our conversation, that that I get hold of Jim Garrison's On the Trail of the Assassin. And on page 56, he tells about a James A. Wilcott, a former CIA finance officer who testified before the House Select Committee, that was the congressional investigation, that he had been that Lee Harvey Oswald had been recruited from the military by the CIA with the express purpose of being a double agent assigned to the USSR, and that actually Mr. Wilcott had financed Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, that was never brought out to the public. You wonder how something as interesting as that coming before a congressional committee, part of the public record, and yet nobody's ever heard of it.
You know, the real reason that I wrote this book, well, the two books, is that I have observed so much in history. Many of the things that I myself experienced, I've had the experience of sitting in their own homes with John Foster Dulles and with Alan Dulles and with people like that, simply because I was the person doing the work that they needed. I was the guy with the briefcase, you might say. As a result, I can affirm that some things happened like this back through the years that have never been in history books. The greatest way to distort history is by omission. I could spend all night telling you how the Pentagon Papers are just as corrupt as could be, because although they dumped 4,000 documents on the doorstep of several newspapers, among them the New York Times, they should have dumped about 5,000 documents, because the most important ones had been extracted, not included. They were extracted, and that's how you change history.
And of course, you think that the what the point that you made was that the CIA intentionally leaked the Pentagon Papers to give the people the impression they were getting the whole story, whereas they got the laundered part of it.
Well, clearly.
All right.
Because if you're in a position to study them carefully, and then if you have some personal experience with some of these events, you can just see that there's just the most important things are just missing. It's like this document, NSAM 263, one of the most important, one of the ones that they have pounded on stone and myself for since the movie. These writers with the big newspapers and the commentators on the big networks say there is no substantial history to support such a statement.
Well, look,
they could look in their own papers when the document came out and see it listed in the headlines. In fact, my book, I show a picture of the front page of a newspaper that says, "All troops out of Vietnam by 65. What more do they want? And they say it doesn't exist.
Well, I hope most of our listeners realize there's a cover-up. Colonel, could you stay with us for the part of the next hour for a while?
I'd be glad to.
Fine.
Another question I had was, he also made a remark that LBJ's secretary walked in on LBJ when he got the call from the assassination, and LBJ's response was, "That SOB will never embarrass me again." And he seemed to think that LBJ was also implicated in this. I was wondering if you had any remark on that.
Well, I think the setting there is not exactly correct. Lyndon Johnson, then the vice president, was in a car, two cars behind the president. And he had no access to secretaries or whatever in that position. Now, on the way home from Dallas, after he had been sworn in as President of the United States, he received a call from the White House and was informed at that time that the White House thought that the assassination had been caused by one man, and you know the story from there on out. And a lot of people have wondered how it was that the White House was informing Johnson that one man named Lee Harvey Oswald killed the president, when the police in Dallas themselves didn't know that at that same hour. In fact, that was a point we made in the movie, that I bought a newspaper in Christchurch, New Zealand, And of course, communications is in real time, so there's no problem with that. But this newspaper in New Zealand carried a complete biographical story about Oswald, all kinds of details, and it was printed and available to people to purchase before Oswald had been arraigned for the crime, something that is, you know, it can't happen that way. So there were some very strange things going on at that time, and you've brought up another one. It's very interesting.
All right, Tony, thanks so much for calling. I think the one thing we have to point out is there is a lot of intentional misinformation and disinformation that's being put out just to confuse the issue. Don't you feel that's true?
Yes.
All right, let's take...
See, that began early because some of the things that were put out in the first minutes after the crime were... Today, we just ignore them completely. One was that there were three bursts of automatic weapon fire. Now, CBS interrupted all their nationwide programs to give that information. Three bursts of automatic weapon fire.
I guess
that's not a single-shot gun.
I guess they didn't have the official line at that point.
Yeah.
Well, look, let's take our caller here on line four. Hello, are you with us?
Hello.
Hello, who's this?
This is Tom from Santa Cruz.
Oh, hi, Tom from Santa Cruz. How are you?
It's a great show.
Well, thank you.
I got a question for Colonel Prouty. Having been up in the inner workings of the government, who do you think's in charge of this whole thing? I mean, you hear people talk about the international bankers and the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and Council of Foreign Relations, all these different groups. From your point of view, where did this? Who was in charge of this whole secret government?
You know, that question arises every single time we get together to talk, and I think it is a most important one because in the book I quote Buckminster Fuller from his wonderful book called Critical Path. You should all read Critical Path by Buckminster Fuller, and he speaks of people, anonymous people, of extreme power, great power, and of traditional power from way back, that he calls the power elite. And he explains it very carefully. In my book, I try to explain it by citing many people like that and some things in my own experience. But here's something that might interest you. Benjamin Disraeli, you know, was Prime Minister of England. And Disraeli said, "The world is governed by far different personages than what is imagined by those not behind the scenes." I take that from my experience of being a true statement. I've seen enough examples of it.
Could I comment for the listener who doesn't know where that quotation comes from? It comes from Disraeli's book called Coningsby. And for those of you who'd like to check it out, it's certainly there, just as the Colonel says. Tom, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
And let's go to line one here. Hello?
Hello?
Who do we have?
Oh, hi. My name's Ben. I'm calling from Santa Cruz.
All right, Ben. Thank you so much for calling, and you have a question for the Colonel.
I have two questions. I've heard that, this is for the Colonel, I've heard that the Golden Triangle, or the Drug Triangle is what they call it, I guess, was set up primarily to finance the Black Op projects for the CIA, and I also heard that, this is my second question.
Well, just take one at a time. And then you can ask the second one.
Okay, I thought you guys were pressing for time here.
Dan, would you repeat that? There was a few words there that I didn't get.
He said that he had heard that the Golden Triangle drug operation had been set up by the CIA to finance their paramilitary organizations that they couldn't get the funding for. In other words, they were running drugs to get money to finance CIA operations. Do you feel there's any truth in such a statement?
Well, I'll tell you, I worked... to some extent, with a man named Al McCoy, who wrote a book called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. I don't know a book on the subject that is better, even though that book now is probably 20 years old. And in that book, he gives a story of how some of the crews operating CIA's proprietary airline, which is a contract job and a huge airline, one of the biggest airlines in the world, were, without question, carrying drugs back and forth as they went on their way with CIA jobs. Now, whether that money went into CIA treasury or not, I don't know. But I do know, if you want to study the subject further, that CIA had a street name in Wall Street, and that which connotes the fact that they have a large account, and that at that time it was of an enormous volume of money, which was not public government money. The CIA had made that money in one way or another through its proprietaries and some of the things they were doing. And of course, a CIA agent was one of the men who founded and operated the Nugan-Hahn Bank. And the Nugan-Hahn Bank years ago was a billion-dollar bank. Mr. Nugan was killed in Australia, and we have not seen Mr. Hahn since that time. And the bank just fell apart. But $1 billion is a lot of money for a young man working for CIA to put together.
If I could just comment, there is another more modern book. It's called Kiss the Boys Goodbye by Monica and William Stevenson that covers much of the same background on the drug and the Golden Triangle, and of course the boys that were left behind in Laos for political expediency, American prisoners who were simply abandoned. Ben, you had one more quick question.
Okay, and the next one will be, there's two parts.
Well, no, you just one more. We've got the lines filled up here.
Okay. And I also heard that a large portion of that black op money went to this alien UFO research that the secret governments are trying to keep under wraps. If in fact it is real, it's probably, I've heard that it was old German technology that they've taken out of Petamunde or somewhere like that. Anyway.
Did you get the question, Colonel?
I'd like to have you repeat it. There's a little bit there. I can't hear the caller too well.
All right, let's turn you up here. Ben, just say it quickly again, would you please?
In regards to the black ops monies,
yes.
A large portion of that I hear was filtered down into the research of this alien UFO thing.
Well, I'll tell you now, people laugh at that.
All right.
But you take a little camping trip one day over in the eastern part of California up against the Nevada line, a place called Groom Lake, and just sit up in the hills there sometimes and just listen, and you'll hear some things that you've never heard before. Don't go too near the fence, because the fence is active. It's hot. But there are things going on. I think it's worth two or three other shows, but I don't know of the link up that way. This program that's going on out at Groom Lake is pretty well funded by what they call black budget. And it'll go by itself.
All right, Ben, thanks so much. Please call again sometime. We have some fascinating programs in this next week.
Yes.
But thanks for being with us.
Okay, bye.
And who do we have here on line three?
Bill.
Bill, thank you for being with us.
Hi, that was me that mentioned the Southeast Asian politics last night on your program also.
Right. Okay, fine. It was good to have you again.
The question I wanted to ask Mr. Prouty was about JFK when he attacked the Old Boy Network and wanting to do away with the monetary debt system and things like that, actually incurred the wrath of the Old Boy Network, which, if you know much about the Masonic organization, that's how they refer to themselves. And I wonder if you could shed some light on that angle of this debate.
Well, Colonel, the question is, is there a Masonic element in this? Is this the military-industrial complex? How do you look upon this power elite that you speak of in your book?
Well, I'll tell you, this is something that has been studied by many people for a long, long time. And you can read books based exactly on what this man has said and on other power centers like that, some in competition with each other. I can just say, like, speaking from my own experience, what I've seen come up, and then you can kind of see how that fits into your ideas, because I don't think this is the place to really get into the fine points of your question. But I happened to be at the Cairo conference in 1943 that was between Churchill, Roosevelt, and Chiang Kai-shek. It was the first time Chiang Kai-shek had been brought onto the world scene as a major power. And then the minute that conference ended, the next day, we flew to Tehran, and there was a conference there, the Tehran conference, between Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill, and Chiang Kai-shek. But you won't find that in a single history book. Now, the reason I can say that with assurance is that I was the pilot that flew the Chinese to Tehran. Now, the reason I bring this up is that Chiang Kai-shek was a puppet. We all knew that. He was a dictator. He was a puppet of T.V. Sung, the wealthiest man in the world in 1943 at the peak of World War II. And T.V. Sung's sister was Mei Ling Sung, and she was the wife of Chiang Kai-shek. She attended these conferences, these four power conferences. This T.V. Sung's sister attended. Now, let's translate that back. What kind of a power structure does that give somebody like that, or that led a man like Churchill himself later on to refer to a high cabal? Now, if Churchill wasn't the high cabal, what's he talking about? Well, when you begin to define those organizations and many others that we could go ahead with, you see, your question is not far off the mark. It's just a question of what you want to call this organization or these organizations, many of them, that among themselves run the world anonymously and from a position of absolute power.
Bill, you are certainly welcome to call back another evening. We'll get into some of these other subjects at a different time, and I know you're interested in masonry and some of the other subjects, and we'll be glad to put on some programs and get into that for you.
I only mention it because it is such a common thread in all these situations.
Well, there is a common thread, but we'll begin to tie them together for you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
For calling.
Bye-bye.
Well, now, let me give our telephone numbers again. It's 464-8295, and let me remind you that you're listening to Radio Liberty here on KFER FM 89.9 on your radio dial. And let's go once again to the telephones here. We have John from Carolinas. John?
Good evening, Stan.
How are you?
Real good. You're coming in loud and clear.
Hey, well, that's great. You know, we just don't know where we're heard, but appreciate your calling so much. Did you have a question for the Colonel?
I would like the Colonel to, if he can, to comment on some of the cover-up after Kennedy's assassination. Specifically, I'm very interested in the autopsy on Kennedy, the discrepancy between the reports from Drs. Boswell and Hume and the reports from the Parkland doctors and some of the real differences in the description of the wounds. I'm also curious about I seem to remember some of the congressional hearings. This is kind of the second part of the question. And I forget if it was Boswell or Hume. One of them said that after they had been questioned by the congressional hearing in the 70s, they walked out of the hearing room and they said they didn't ask the right question. Any comment on that, Colonel?
You know, this business of the cover story, which includes, of course, the autopsy, not only the one gunman and the three bullets, but the autopsy situation, is a part of the whole thing. It's a major part. And people can research this business of the autopsy, as they've done from dawn till midnight for years, and all you learn is that it was not a normal autopsy. It was not a legal autopsy. They should never have removed the body from Texas. Law requires that a trial be held whenever there's a murder in the state where there was a murder. Each step of the way, the magazine of the American Medical Association recently published reports from two of their men. They brought two of their people in and had them tell their little stories all over again about the autopsy and all that sort of thing. What is it that forces, that requires a reputable organization such as the American Medical Association and its fine publication to take time off to repeat the mythology set in motion by the Warren Commission and the established cover story of the death of Kennedy? It is not that complex. My God, bullets don't turn circles, guns don't shoot through trees, etc., etc. And once you decide that, the rest of it, all of us know, is cover story, not truth. It's contrived, and it is forced upon us now for 30 years. It's time we stood up and said, no, we're not going to listen to anything anymore. Autopsy, flying bullets, and all the rest of it.
You know, I think one of the most interesting things that I've seen in the last year was the massive attack on Oliver Stone. I mean, everybody attacked him. The right attacked him. The left attacked him. All of the establishment newspapers and television. I didn't see one good word about the movie anyplace, and yet I thought it was a phenomenal movie, and you could see that the audience was gripped by this. It had an intense emotional appeal. People knew that they were seeing the truth, and yet, you know, when they got out of the theater and suddenly they see all these attacks, pretty soon you say, well, how could it be true when everybody's attacking it?
You know, Stanley, the way you put that is very important. I was on a platform at a major university with a panel, and a panel of experts, and one of them was not an expert on the Kennedy assassination, but he was assistant editor of one of the largest newspapers in the United States. And the dean of the university had just started the question period going, and some student got up and asked about the movie and all that. And immediately this editor, who had a microphone right in front of him, said, "The main trouble with the movie is that it is untrue." Well, I had a microphone, and I was sitting right beside this editor. And I said, "Mr. Smith," I said, "you name any subject that was covered by the movie that is untrue, and I'll talk with you about it right here on this platform now." He never said another word that night, as about 1,000 students clapped as hard as they could clap. See, their stories won't hold. They say these words, but when they publish their newspapers, you don't have a microphone that you can call back to them and say, "Fellas, your newspaper's all wrong," like I could do when he's sitting beside me on the platform.
And I think another interesting thing is I know that you've been going on small radio stations all across the country telling your story. I suspect that you haven't been on Donahue yet, though. But the average person who's in our listening audience tonight probably has never heard of you before, nor heard of your books, nor heard your story. And most people don't even believe there was a colonel, not necessarily sat on the park bench, but who actually communicated with Garrison and gave him information about the background of the assassination.
Well, I must confirm that I appeared on Good Morning America and on Entertainment Tonight, and I was treated very, very honestly. In other words, it was a fair program on each one. I was on Larry King's show, not the TV, the talk show at night, and I was on with Bohannon instead of King. And again, he's a good, rough interrogator, but honest, and we had a good program. So I'm not covering everybody there with the same paintbrush. It's just that where they are closest to the power centers, they cannot change. They have no privilege of changing the cover story.
Well, thank goodness we do have a few places we can get the truth out. John, did you have any other comment for the colonel?
I was wondering if the colonel's familiar with, I forget the title of the book and the author, but it was one of the Parkland doctors who recently published a book, and if the colonel is familiar with that and what he thinks of it.
Say that again, the book was what?
It was written by one of the doctors who was at the Parkland Hospital.
Crenshaw.
Yes. What do you think of the book?
Well, you know, I won't read things like that because the autopsy, although it is very important, and what the doctors did is very important, is not going to solve our problem because we already know that 3 bullets by themselves from this one gunman from a 6th floor didn't do it. We already know that's physically impossible by the story they've told us. So all the rest of it is just more of the same incorrect work. Unfortunately, the doctors worked under terrible stress. People were ordering them to do things that they ordinarily don't have to do. And a very competent person, Cyril Weck, you probably know Dr. Cyril Weck, who was the head of the National Society in his work, has already explained all these things to anybody that was listening. He's a real famous, honorable man. And then along comes a fellow some 30 years later and says, "Well, I want to change my story and tell you this. I wish him well, but it doesn't help things the way Stone helped it by hitting it right on the nose."
All right, fine. Well, thanks so much for calling, John, and look forward to hearing from you again.
Oh, I'm sure you will.
Oh, okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Colonel, have you come into much in the way of criticism or opposition to your telling the story as you've told it this evening?
Oh, well, there's no question about that. And, in case you haven't noted it, there is a marvelous paperback book out called JFK, The Story of the Film, written by Oliver Stone. The unusual thing is that it contains every word spoken by the actors during the movie, and every time there is a what we would call contentious point, he has inserted notes, and they are the most marvelous compendium of notes I have seen on this subject. And then the latter half of the book is entitled The Debate. And in The Debate, it's all these articles written by major writers and things on major commentators with TV against Oliver Stone, against me, against Garrison, and people like that. I have never seen a book so even-handedly portray a very important event in our history. And if you read that, that'll answer your question. We really took a beating because, you know, we don't have the ability to respond to these fellows at the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times. They can write what they want, and they don't open the door to us. But they did let some letters get published, and on that basis, we had a pretty good little battle going there.
All right, fine. Well, let's take Ben from Santa Cruz. Ben, are you there?
Yeah, it's me again.
Okay.
I got one more question.
All right, fine.
This is in regards to the actual shooting of President Kennedy in the car, and I got a hold of a video from a guy named Bill Cooper who supposedly picked up a copy of a video made of the Zapruder film before it was cut, you know, before they had edited it out, and it shows the driver turning around and finishing off the president with a kill shot to the head, is how they worded it. Word for word, right out of the movie. And I don't know. What's the colonel think about that? Is that a fact, or is that possible?
Yeah, I've heard of that now for the last two or three years. You know, Cooper is notorious for coming up with very interesting things from time to time, all the way from UFOs to what have you. When I first came into the Army in 41, 42, I did a lot of training of soldiers and officers on firing weapons. And one of the things you have to do when you fire a weapon is aim it. And this situation that Cooper describes is this guy holding some kind of a weapon over his shoulder, his right shoulder, and with his left hand while he's supposed to be driving a car, doesn't give him any opportunity to aim the thing, among other things. I think it's pure fantasy.
And probably Jackie might have noticed that, and you know, the Secret Service people that were on the side of the car probably would have noticed it, you know.
Connolly was right there.
Yeah.
He was in a jump seat right within arm's reach of the man, which people seem to ignore that.
Well, you know, the tragedy is there is all this intentional confusion, and what you have to understand is that they're funneling so many impulses into your mind that you can't think clearly. Forget about all the side issues. Somebody wanted him killed. Who did it and why? And I think that Colonel Prouty answers many of those in his very excellent book, and I'd commend it highly to you, Ben.
I got one more question.
All right, fine. You got one more question. Let me just quickly give our telephone numbers here first. It's 464-8295. 464-8295. We just have one line still open. So go ahead, Ben. Last question now.
All right. In the last couple of years, they've been arresting these computer hackers, and one in particular, Kevin Mitnick. I guess he broke into a network called DocMaker or DocMaster, and he downloaded some files regarding this type of stuff, this covert stuff, and that's one of the reasons they went after him. Have you heard anything about that? And especially, I don't know, just what's your comment on that?
Well, you know, just talking about people breaking into this covert files, computer hackers, he wondered whether you'd heard about somebody being arrested for breaking into some of the CIA's secret files.
Files on the
assassination
stuff.
Stanley, if the American public knew how thoroughly bugged every one of us is and how easy it is and how much it happens, especially against the business world, we would know that such stories really are just barely putting your toe in the water. This business of the spread of the gaining of secret intelligence through communication intercept and things like that
is one of the biggest businesses there is today, and it is, I understand that at least 85% of the international business traffic, ordinary business traffic, is intercepted every day and read out by computers to the point where the messages that they want, the hot ones, are transcribed almost in real time. It's unbelievable to gather a meeting of some of the highest people in the world, in this country, manufacturing, bankers, lawyers, educators, over 1,500 men at what was called the White House Conference on Business Looks at the World of 1990. Now, this is 1972. As a summary of this three-day meeting among these top-level people at which the president spoke, every cabinet officer spoke, and everybody else, a very highly detailed meeting, Roy Ash, the president of Litton Industries, got up and said, as a summary of what we've been saying, I see that the consensus is that as our country is moving more and more toward a form of socialism, the communist world is moving more and more toward a form such as our way of operation, and that the two countries will come together sometime in the middle of 1990. Now, that gentleman was making that statement in that highly qualified group of people, from the president on down, in 72. 18 years later, what happened? The two countries have come. Now, that's not a guess. He knew what he was talking about, and that's what I mean. These things are done by plan. They are not happenstance. So very important things like that.
Well, if I could comment on that, the reason it was interesting to me, because I have an interview, and one of these nights I'll play it for our listeners, with a man who was the chief investigator for the Reese Committee on the which was a congressional committee that was investigating the Great Foundations back in 1954. And I'll play that for the listeners as they talked. At that time, the head of the Ford Foundation was talking about exactly what you're saying. We are going to move America to the left, and Russia will move to the right, and eventually we can merge. And you can, of course, see that now with the move towards the New World Order. A little scary.
And what it means is, of course, as we, if we think about this carefully, sovereignty does not exist today. And that's not my statement. I get that from a book written by Walter Riskin. The book is called Risk and Other Four-Letter Words, and Walter Riskin was the number one banker in the United States back some 10 or 15 years ago. And he writes in his book that because of the instantaneous communications and finance and transport all over the world, sovereignty no longer exists. Now, this is a most dramatic truth because it affects every one of our lives and changes the way business is done throughout the world, because we are now immersed in the one world order. Whether we know it or not, we're in it.
We sure are. Well, look, let's go to talk to Vernon here on three. Vernon, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank
you.
Yeah,
I wanted to ask the Colonel a question here. I was recently watching C-SPAN, and they had ex-President Gerald Ford on, who was the last surviving member of the Warren Commission. And Larry King asked him about the Kennedy assassination, to which Gerald Ford replied that there was no conspiracy, that the findings of the commission were definitive, and that it was a one-man thing. Would you care to comment on why what Gerald Ford's part is in all this, et cetera?
I discussed it briefly earlier because I said that every single president since Kennedy has said the same thing. In other words, will not waver one word from the findings of the Warren Commission report. But think of the reasons. I also said a while ago that Lyndon Johnson thought that some of those bullets had been fired at him. He asked J. Edgar Hoover that. He said, were the bullets aimed at me? That's Lyndon Johnson. Bullets are probably the greatest educators in the world. Then right behind him comes Nixon, who was in Dallas at the moment the president was killed, even though in four different books that I have, he tells different stories of being up LaGuardia or flying up to New York or so on and so on. He was in Dallas. He was not going to. I don't know why he changes his story, or why in the Watergate business he has these strange tapes that he won't release where he talks about the Bay of Pigs thing when he means the Kennedy assassination. Nixon understands it. In other words, if you've been shot at and had a near miss, or if a friend of yours has been shot at and been killed, I'll tell you, you've been educated. And this is what causes this. There is no way for these people to say anything else. I mean, we're all human. Let's believe that.
So basically, you know, you're just saying that Ford has just said, I'm more in a position to live. I'd rather live than be shot.
Well, and the other thing is, I'm saying very clearly this, I know Gerald Ford is not dumb. And I know that Jimmy Carter is not dumb, and Ronald Reagan is not dumb, because you would have to be quite ignorant to think that the report of the Warren Commission makes sense if all you did was consider the physical problems.
Right. The thing that struck me about Gerald Ford was he was actually on the commission, is what he'd said, that did the investigation. He says he was the last remaining person that was still alive from that commission,
well,
and having gone through the investigation.
He was very active. He went to more meetings of the Warren Commission than any other member of the commission. He wrote a book about the hearings before the hearings were published, something that they had all agreed not to do, but he did it. In other words, he's very active on this Warren Commission thing, but he's wrong. And, you know, you can't say he's wrong because he's dumb. He's got to be.
Well, no, I just, you know, I wanted that perspective thrown in because, you know, here you have a gentleman that's getting older in age, which I might ask you, Colonel, too, is don't you fear for your life?
I always get asked that, but, you know,
you haven't been asked it tonight, though, I didn't think.
I've been through three wars. I've been through two books now, and my birthday is day after tomorrow, and I'll be 76 years old. So I can't worry about the same thing every day.
Look, Vernon, thank you.
That's it.
Thanks so much for calling.
You're welcome.
Good night. And let's see. Our next caller is Bill from Santa Cruz. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Fine.
I'd like to...
Is this the bill we had before, or is this a new bill?
Yes, it is. No, it's the same old bill.
All right. Same old bill.
That's an interesting subject, too, what they're doing with our old bills. Anyway, I wanted to ask the Colonel about what he mentioned about Russia or USSR and America becoming one, basically. And I've heard, I've read and heard that the Illuminati in times past were instrumental in financing the revolution in Russia, and it's an experiment that the rest of us will join soon, where religion is outlawed, and it's Nathan Rothschild's plan, the Illuminati, which was the predecessor to the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission of today, and that it's not just an accident that the world, that Russia and America is coming together. It's a long-range plan, and we're soon to be involved in the experiment that Russia has gone through as far as outlawing religion and making the the old Masonic conspiracy work ever again.
Well, no, you're sort of going from Masonic conspiracy to Illuminati to Nathan Rothschild. And
well, they're all the same. They're involved. It was Nathan Rothschild who helped finance that revolution, and it's also the Nathan Rothschild who is also a benefactor of our monetary debt system. So it's not really that far-fetched. It's all the same people. And the continuity is a group of people who have been together for centuries. I wonder if Mr. Prouty has much more to say about that. I know it's not a safe subject to talk about as well, but I think people need to know.
Well, listen, I hope that you will have an opportunity to read my book, because what you're saying is within the area of fact and truth historically. The thing is that these different names, you know, Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Masonic, on and on and on,
mm-hmm.
those are the groupings that people see within their own realm of experience, but they don't see the things that, for instance, Nehru saw in governing what he tried to do with India, or what Chiang Kai-shek saw when he tried to govern China and found out he had bosses, or what Churchill was trying to do in England when he said he was working with a high cabal, you see.
Exactly, that high cabal is who I'm speaking
that
about.
Are not, well, the thing about that is that there very definitely is that type of power, but it is my belief, and again, I'll say this in a singular way, in a very objective, a very subjective way, it is my belief that people like those people on the Trilateral Commission are the lobbyists, you might say, for the real power makers. Because, I mean, we understand lobbyists. If General Electric has lobbyists, we know those lobbyists are running all over Washington talking to congressmen, but they're working for General Motor, for General Electric or for General Motors, et cetera.
Right.
Well,
okay.
The Trilateral people are lobbyists for the people who put them on that commission. Cecil Rhodes, for example, set more of this in motion probably than any other man. I don't know if you noticed it, but when the Ill Winds program came in and they found all this bribery and contract trouble with the Navy about 2 or 3 years ago, the first man that was tried and the first man that was sent to jail in that was the son of the man Cecil Rhodes sent to this country to cause the breakup of the United States. Well, we know those things, you see, but those are only parts of the story. It's a big story, and you're on the right track, and keep going.
Bill?
Keep in mind that I still agree with Buckminster Fuller that the real high-level people remain anonymous, and that's the definition of them. They're beyond reach.
Well, speaking of high-level, could you shed some light on the theory of the Spear of Destiny and who holds that?
I'll tell you what, Bill. We're getting way off the assassination.
Yeah,
well, why don't you? You ought to read the Colonel's book. There's some very good references in there, and he talks about some of the very powerful bankers in America. Read his book, and then call in again when we're really getting onto that subject rather than the assassination. Okay.
All right.
I know you're interested in it, but you're putting the Colonel on the spot here. He's an expert on the assassination, and that's what we want to talk about tonight.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to go to the lovely Carolyn. Is this the lovely Carolyn?
This is the lovely Carolyn. Thank you, Stan, and happy birthday in 2 days, Colonel.
Thank you.
I actually wanted to get a little bit off field, but not really directly, one thing I noticed tonight in all of your talking about the assassination of JFK is you never mentioned partisan politics, which I find is absolutely amazing in the whole almost 2 hours. It was basically just the conspiracy theory without Democrat or Republican mentioned. And you did mention the upstart young president who had his own ideas versus what the good old boy network had in mind. And the question I guess I have for you, which is a little bit of far field from Kennedy himself, is what do you think Clinton's chances of survival are, or is he part of the old good old boy network?
What do I think? What is it?
She's expressing what some people have said. They're concerned about Clinton's health. There are many people are very worried about Albert Gore, President Gore, and there are many conservatives are praying for Clinton's health.
Well, you know, I find this is one of the problems with talk shows. You see, I wrote the book, so what I think is all out there somewhere, and a lot of times I can't come back to it, but she started off with something that I really believe in about the partisan politics working its way into this. I happened to be working for the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Gates, at the time Eisenhower left because of his two terms. At the time Nixon was defeated, and everybody expected Nixon was going to win, and Kennedy won by a very slim margin. And you're exactly right. People in Washington, many of them, and many of them in the business sector, just hated Kennedy, even though he hadn't served the day, simply because he interrupted the 8 years of Eisenhower politics that Nixon had been trained and rehearsed to carry on for 8 more years. They thought this was all in the bag. It would happen. And frankly, that's at the root of the opposition that grew against Kennedy. It began in that narrow defeat of Nixon. And Nixon always thought he was cheated, you know. I think he believes that to this day. Somebody counting the wards in Chicago did him in. But
probably some truth to that, too.
Yeah, your point is so well taken, and I'm sorry that it doesn't come up sooner, although it's basic to what I've put in the book, and I'm sorry I kind of forget to mention it. But it's a darn good point.
Well, I will definitely get a copy through and find out through Stan exactly where off the air to get a copy, because I would like to read it. But I really didn't call earlier because I actually seem to call almost every night, and I didn't want to hog the lines from a bunch of other people, and I was also just enjoying listening. Well, but with that, since there's probably other callers, and even if there's not, you and Stan need to wrap it up. And so again, Stan, I'll thank you for another great educational program, and thank you, Colonel, for being on the air, and happy birthday again.
This concludes Side 2. If you'd like to write Dr. Stan for a list of other resources or any of the correspondence, address your correspondence to Radio Liberty, P.O. Box 13, Santa Cruz, California, zip 95063.